Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Ashley Watts, the Kentucky Chamber's new president and CEO, began a recently published op-ed by writing, "Society cannot incarcerate its way out of the public health crisis that is drug addiction. But in making the possession of drugs a felony rather than a misdemeanor, Kentucky shows a stubborn willingness to continue to try." It was especially striking that this point of view is expressed by the leader of the state's business community, and it seemed an indication that indeed times are changing. Ashley Watts joins us to discuss her views on how Kentucky has gone about dealing with its very serious addiction crisis and how we might turn toward a response with rehabilitation at its core. Thanks for joining us, Ashley.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You recently succeeded longtime Chamber President and CEO Dave Adkisson, and this op-ed was your first in that role, and it was almost right after you assumed the role. I take it that our drug addiction situation was top of mind.
It really is. And when I was thinking of kind of the first op-ed that I wanted to release, and usually from the chamber, we do one every couple of months on whatever kind of is the topic du jour, whatever issue that we're covering or the General Assembly or an election. But really kind of through the transition, this has been one of the biggest issues for the chamber in the last couple of years. And it's really been brought to the forefront. I often say, you know, 10 years ago, this is nothing the Chamber of Commerce would have ever really gotten involved with. But our times have changed, the workforce has changed, and this issue has obviously grown significantly here in Kentucky. And just personally, I have been the chamber's lobbyist and advocate for the last 7 years. And this is one of the issues that really just kind of was one of my favorite things to work on at criminal justice reform and kind of taking a new approach to it, putting a business spin on it, talking about workforce and talking about the cost of the budget and the cost of the workforce. So I kind of wanted this to be my first op-ed. I wanted it to be pretty bold. It's gotten a lot of great pickup, a lot of great responses. And so I really wanted it to kind of be one of those things that people would talk about after they read.
And you acknowledge that times have changed. I take it you picked up on that everywhere you've been. Can you kind of elaborate on that? What have you heard and seen?
Yeah. So I would say about 4 years ago, businesses from all across Kentucky started telling us, you know, you really need to look at more criminal justice reform. You need to look at felony expungement. We're having problems with our employees, you know, not being able to pass a drug test, or longtime employees that have been very loyal, but that now have gotten into some trouble or gotten into a problem. And we really started realizing that everyone, no matter what kind of demographic in Kentucky, knows someone, loves someone that's been impacted by this. And it really did, in the last couple of years, move from a public health crisis to also a workforce crisis. We have people who are really struggling with this new reality. And a couple years ago, I think every business would have said, you know, we're a drug-free workplace, zero tolerance, no more chances. And really, that is not the way that we can really operate anymore. And so businesses are having to navigate this new reality of workforce. And we as the chamber really want to be there to kind of help guide them, help show them the way, help figure out solutions. And that's what we've been trying to do the last couple of years.
I've heard it said that some businesses, not all, but there's something of a little mini trend going on of some businesses considering amnesty for employees who are addicted and have a problem and they don't want to lose them. And the employee, of course, doesn't want to lose his or her job. And they can come to their employer in confidence and discuss their issue.
We've heard of things like that, too. I don't know of a real scenario here in Kentucky. And, of course, businesses may not want to let it be known. But what is happening is, you know, good longtime employees sometimes are finding themselves addicted and in trouble. And the employer wants to help this person. And so if they come forward, sometimes they could give them treatment, help them through this. Really, that's what we're trying to provide at the chamber, are resources for employers, really helping them figure out how to go about some of this. If they want to be second chance employers, helping them look at their HR policies and adapt to this new reality. Also looking at the legal liability of it all. Sometimes it's a scary thing for employers to do, even though they want to and they know it's the right thing. So that's what we've been trying to do. And really, that we feel like that's our space in this. this is really helping employers kind of destigmatize the whole issue of addiction, bring people back into the workforce, because we know that a job is key to reducing recidivism. Once someone is addicted, goes through treatment, or is incarcerated and comes out, they need a job for that stability to kind of make sure their life stays on track. It really is key, and we want to be part of that solution.
And you point out in the op-ed that as conditions exist right now, we kind of stack the deck against that possibility of returning as a productive member of society.
We absolutely do. And, you know, one of the main points of the op-ed was to consider that Kentucky should defelonize possession. So right now in Kentucky, possession is a felony. And as we all know, most of the time, felonies stay with you for quite some time. We were instrumental in passing felony expungement a couple years ago for low-level felonies that if you don't commit another crime, that after a certain period of time and paying a fine, you can get that erased. But some of these people don't have that luxury to have that done. And so a felony really is a scarlet letter on your record. And we want people after treatment, after rehabilitation, to get back into the workforce, get back into the community, be a productive citizen. And with that felony on your record, it really does hold you back from that. I have a good friend who we work with on these issues together, and she had gotten into some trouble when she was a young woman, got into some opioids and drug issues. She had gone to jail for, I think, 8 months. She still has felonies on her record, and she's now a mother. She's gone to college. She has a job, and she can't go on her kids' field trips because of that felony.
Oh.
And as a mother myself, those kind of stories of people who have done exactly what society have told them to do, they never did it again.
And so the punishment is extended to
her
children.
It really is that cycle. And so we are really holding people back when I think we all know that it's an addiction. It's one of those when you know better, you do better. And we know that addiction is a disease. And so that we're treating it much differently really is not helpful to anyone. And we can tell that kind of being this tough on crime and incarcerating people, it just simply hasn't worked. We haven't lowered the number of crimes. We haven't lowered the number of drug addicts. And our prisons are busting at the seams right now.
And you address that in this op-ed as well, that our prisons are indeed bursting at the seams. And there was the solution to that has been to lease private prisons, almost as an act of economic development and job growth. What's your take on that?
And that's a confusing thought to me, that we as Kentuckians would accept private prisons and building more prisons and incarcerating more of these low-level offenders and tout that as economic development. That's not really the business growth that the business community, or I don't think any Kentuckians should really want. You know, the days of private prisons we thought were gone, they are now back because of the overcrowding in the jails. And most of the overcrowding, when you look at the numbers from the Justice Cabinet, are low-level Class D felonies, which really can equate to drug crimes or property crimes. And so we really need to figure out exactly what we're going to do about those two things. But I think defelonizing possession and making it a misdemeanor, now there are some things that have to go along with it. You have to figure out kind of the money trail of who pays for it. Does the cost get shifted to locals? All of that has to be figured out. But I think we can do that. Tennessee, our neighbor to the south, who oftentimes we emulate their public policy, they've defelonized possession. They're a deep Republican state, and they've done it. Other states have done it and have seen really good outcomes in lowering the prison population, and safety has not been endangered at all. So it's a pretty simple solution, I think, if we could figure out the logistics of it, to really help our prison population decrease, but also not stick people with a felony for the rest of their lives.
Numbers are often really good at telling a story. And again, in your op-ed, you mentioned that there is a way to quantify the human and the financial toll that results of felonizing possession. Can you give us a little bit of that information?
Yeah. I mean, I think numbers are always kind of what speak to business people. So whenever we're looking at issues like this, we always like to have the data to back it up. And when you look at the number of people that have been incarcerated and the percentage growth over the last couple of years because of Class D felonies, it's not only a workforce issue that people are, you know, not able to enter the workforce, it's also a budget budgetary issue. I mean, we're spending way too much money on corrections. It's one of those kind of what we would say the hole in the bucket of the budget that's leaking uncontrollably. Corrections is growing at a much, much faster rate than the average rate of the state budget. So it's not only a workforce issue and a drain on employers and on employees, it's also a drain on all taxpayers as well.
The numbers that really leap off the page have to do with incarcerated women.
Yeah.
Tell us more.
You know, Kentucky is one of the top states, or I think it's the second state with the most incarcerated mothers. There's more children in Kentucky with incarcerated mothers than almost any other state in the nation. And again, as a mother, you know, I don't simply think that women in Kentucky are worse than women in other states. So we must be doing something differently, and it's just not working. And so we should look at other states, you know, other, you know, conservative type states, southern states that have really led on criminal justice reform and see how that's working. And most of the times when you look at the women that are incarcerated here in Kentucky, they all stem back to the opioid epidemic or drug addiction. And so really figuring that out and investing in rehabilitation and not incarceration is the way we need to look forward.
You've already touched on a number of reasons for the business community to be concerned about this, but I wonder if you could kind of crystallize why the business community should make it a priority to find some new way to approach addiction.
Yeah, I mean, it really is a workforce issue. It is. Here in Kentucky, we have a workforce shortage. We have more open jobs than people looking for jobs. We have a very low workforce participation rate. And one of those reasons is because of our high rate of incarceration. So we want these people that have been incarcerated who are in jails or prisons across the state, once they come back into the community, which most of them do, don't we all want them to get jobs? Don't we all want them to reenter society, to be, you know, productive citizens, to pay their taxes? We should all want that for our own, for Kentuckians. And so the business community really wants, you know, they need a workforce, and these people are here that need jobs. It just, we have to kind of figure out how to make those things match. And that's what we've at the Chamber really have been helping employers look at, is they all want to, I think, do the right thing, be a second chance employer, but they don't know how. And so that's what we're doing, is trying to connect people who are coming out of recovery, who are kind of getting that second chance at life, connecting them with employers who need employees, and seeing how those two groups match together. It's also a huge budgetary drain. You know, the Chamber, our overall top strategic priority is education. And the more and more money from our dwindling state budget that goes to corrections and jails and private prisons is, you know, less and less dollars for really what we should all agree is a top budget priority, which is education, preparing our next workforce to ensure that this does not happen again.
Ashley Watts is president and CEO of the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce. Thanks so much, Ashley.
Thank you for having me.
The words used to describe drug addiction and those suffering from it can either perpetuate the stigma that's attached to the disease or can help people move beyond it, and journalists have a responsibility to stop using stigmatizing language. That's how an article for Kentucky Health News begins. It's written by Melissa Patrick, and she's here to share with us what she learned in researching, reporting, and writing about why words matter when writing about addiction. Thanks for coming in, Melissa.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
The basis of your article was a workshop that was held in Ashland in mid-November. What was that about?
The premise of that workshop was to help journalists across the state, in particular in eastern Kentucky and the surrounding Appalachian states, to learn how to write about addiction and to offer them information about addiction, to be informative, as well as to offer tips on how to write about it.
Was the thinking that journalists set the tone in terms of the words that we use, and so it's important to begin there?
Each of the panels at the workshop often circled back around to the language that journalists use and how it matters in talking about addiction. For example, in learning about the biology of addiction, simply knowing that addiction is a disease and that we need to write about it as such becomes very important, because then the words you use change.
Are there words that we are using now that we should not be using?
So in particular, the word addict comes to mind. That basically is a word that has a negative connotation and is describing a person just as if a person was a diabetic and you only describe them as a diabetic. You know, that person is more than that. They are a person first. And so the same goes with a person who has an addiction or who has a substance use disorder, which is the preferred language. That is a term that is discouraged in describing someone with an addiction. You know, there are some other obvious ones, you know, junkie, crackhead. Those are words that you see less and less now, but that do creep up occasionally. And those words, of course, are discouraged.
In your article, you quote a reporter, Bishop Nash is his name. He said that he's had to learn to write differently about addiction. And I'm wondering, how did he go about making that change?
Well, Bishop really, the bottom line is he said he had to learn better to do better. And so he had to learn. A person in their community directly confronted him and the newspaper that he worked for every time they would use stigmatizing language in a story or a headline. And in having someone directly confront him and explain to him why, not just don't do it, but why that would be the wrong choice of words, really helped him, as he said, change his heart and then therefore also change his writing. And so he learned differently and then changed the way he wrote.
Tell us about Lynn O'Connell. She's the Associate Director of Community Services in the Division of Addiction Sciences in Family Medicine at Marshall Health in Huntington. She discovered something important when she got in touch with newsrooms asking them to print less stigmatizing headlines.
Well, and Lynn O'Connell is actually who Bishop Nash attributed his change of heart to.
That's who gave him the call.
That's who gave him the call. And occasionally still gives him a call, but much less often. But Lynn O'Connell, as part of her work with Marshall Health and with the community of Huntington, took it upon herself to call the newspapers, call the media outlets, and let them know when they were using stigmatizing language. And then once she started doing this, she realized that they didn't know better and it wasn't intentional, that they simply didn't know better. And so she put together a set of guidelines to help media not use stigmatizing language when writing about opioid use disorders or substance use disorders. And then she went about teaching classes in the area. And so through that, in particular, Bishop Nash said it changed the way their newsroom wrote about addiction issues.
She talked about using what she called people first language. What did she mean by that?
Well, people first language allows you to put the person first, allows you to define the person first instead of defining that person as their condition or their health condition. And an example of that is, as we discussed, you know, instead of using the word addict, you would say a person with a substance use disorder. And we should do that in all areas, whether we're talking about someone who has autism, a person with autism, as opposed to calling them autistic. It's a way of putting the person first.
She also noted the importance of focusing on the medical nature of a substance use disorder and using language that promotes recovery. How do we do that exactly?
Well, Lynn was very adamant. You know, she said, addiction is a disease and we need to treat it as such. And basically what she was getting at is that when we talk about addiction, we need to talk about it as a medical condition, not a choice. And that in doing that, we use different language. And she offered an example, one being, for example, when someone goes in to get a drug test, oftentimes the common language is to say it was clean or dirty. Well, we don't do that with any other blood test. You know, if someone goes in to check their cholesterol, they don't have a clean or dirty result. And so that being said, the same language, that same medical language should be used when we talk about addiction. It should be a positive or a negative test. And then the same goes with making sure that we use language that recognizes addiction as a disease, a person with a substance use disorder.
Getting back to the reporter, Bishop Nash, he was concerned that readers might roll their eyes and say, oh, the PC police are now out. But he's gotten past that. Mm-hmm. And how did he move on?
Well, you know, he circled back around to the science of addiction several times. It was very important for him in particular to understand that addiction is a disease, and then how the disease process worked. And we did have someone at the workshop walk the reporters through that. And that in learning more about it as a disease, it really made him recognize that it's not a politically correct issue. It's more about the science of it, as he said it. We need to speak about it as a medical condition. And that allowed him to separate from that idea that it's a politically correct issue. But, you know, I run into that myself, you know, where people, I was at a mental health conference and a person said, if you don't use language that people understand, they won't know what you're writing about. For example, everyone recognizes the word addiction. They don't always recognize the word substance use disorder. And so there is a fine line between using a politically correct language and also making sure that your audience understands what you're saying. And Bishop worked through that on first reference. He says substance use disorder, a person with a substance use disorder. And then on second reference, he'll say a person with an addiction, still putting the person first, but using language that people understand. And that has been one of the ways he's worked through that.
And, you know, when I think about it, this is certainly not the first time in history that we've come across this. We had to overcome being set in our ways about the way we wrote about gender, for example. Or even race or ethnicity. This seems very similar to that.
It does. And one of the points that was made at the conference was that this is a decision and a commitment that each newsroom must make to change the stigmatizing language, and that it is a conscious thought and choice to do so.
Well, speaking of the newsroom, for most publications, there is a headline style. There's a word count limit, that kind of thing. It's trying to stuff 10 pounds into a 5-pound bag. And when you're trying to be sensitive as well about what you're stuffing into that 5-pound bag, that can be a real challenge. But I take it that there was some talk about that.
There was a bit of pushback from the audience suggesting that if in fact we are changing the way we talk about addiction and the words that we use about addiction, that we need to come up with some smaller words in order to fit them in the headlines in particular. And that is probably true and will evolve, I think. But Bishop Nash pushed back really hard on that. He said that what he thought it amounted to was that our editors and our copy desk people also need to be educated and informed about addiction so that they can understand the importance of not using stigmatizing language, and that it's more important to make that change than to fit the words into a headline.
Well, some enterprising person needs to come up with a glossary for us.
Mm-hmm.
You close your article with a quote from Nash that goes well beyond reporting this particular beat, drug addiction. He said, I believe that state and local journalists in particular have a moral imperative for the greater public good in the communities they serve. Do you think that gets lost in the day-to-day business of grinding out news and information?
I do think it gets lost a bit. However, I think that our community newspapers, because they're all part of the community.
And small town.
They're small
right.
town. Thank you. Everyone knows each other, that they likely do a better job than the bigger newspapers. And if they don't, I do think there is a moral imperative to do so. What I'm thinking about right now is the idea of helicopter reporting, especially on this issue of opioids and substance use disorders, where big newsrooms helicopter into these small towns and write their story. And usually it's an important story that needs to be told, but sometimes they lose the nuances of why the individual with the substance use disorder, how they got there. And so the moral imperative, I think, often in a community newspaper is to tell that whole story, to recognizing not only how that person got to the point of having a substance use disorder, but to also just as often as they can tell stories of recovery and treatment and hope, because those are the stories that are also just as important as what often gets told, which is the criminalization aspect of it.
This is one of those subjects, it seems to me, where hard, cold objectivity, which we want, as close to it as we can get as human beings, kind of collides with essential sensitivity.
Mm. I agree. And as a reporter, you do have to tell the story. You have to tell the news. And in doing that, you have to tell the news related to the facts at hand. But you also have an imperative to make sure you're using credible sources to share the story. In this case of substance use disorders, make sure you're speaking to medical professionals about what recovery and treatment and options for treatment look like, as opposed to someone who maybe is not appropriately informed on those topics. And I think that falls under that moral imperative that we have to make sure we're not only telling the news and the facts, but also telling the whole story and using credible sources to do that.
Melissa Patrick is a reporter for Kentucky Health News. Thank you for coming in, Melissa.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, micro-credentials and why we should notice teachers who have them.
These teachers who are engaging in micro-credentialing are seeing statistically significant impact on student performance.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
The qualifications of school teachers to prepare today's students for jobs and careers of the future have been called into question by some politicians in recent years. So we thought it might be enlightening to hear about one way that teachers can and are keeping current and sharpening their classroom skills by qualifying for micro-credentials. Dr. Jennifer Carroll and Robert Brown from the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative are among the most knowledgeable in the country when it comes to micro-credentialing, so we're pleased that they've taken the time to join us here on Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having us.
And so let's begin with a definition. What is a micro-credential?
Micro-credentials are a new and exciting way that educators are engaging in what we call clinical professional learning that actually takes place in the classroom where educators apply their learning in their practice and collect evidence and artifacts that demonstrate their competence. So a micro-credential is actually a digital form of certification that indicates that a person has demonstrated skill and competency and mastery of particular skills. So rather than, I call it the 6-hour sit and get that a lot of times educators receive as their professional learning, where they go sit in a conference and listen, this actually gives educators the opportunity to select a skill or competency that they want or need to know and engage in personalized professional learning around that skill or competency, apply it in their classroom or in their building with their students, so within the context of their work, practice, reflect, apply, gather evidence and artifacts that show that they have acquired that skill or competency, and then receive a digital form of certification. Many times it's a badge. It doesn't have to be a badge, but a digital icon that indicates that they have mastered that skill or competency that they set out to learn.
As they're applying what they are learning or have learned in the classroom,
Is there some sort of measurement or evaluation that happens somewhere along the way to see how well they're doing it?
The issuers, the agencies, or the organizations that develop these micro-credentials embed within them performance criteria. So in order to earn a micro-credential, it will give you a rubric and directions about what it takes in order to pass or earn that micro-credential. And then that's what I think is another unique quality about micro-credentials is that they are actually scored by a person. So, the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative has several micro-credentials that they have developed and that are available on an online platform. And when educators submit those to us, then we at the co-op are the ones that score those. So they get feedback from a real person. It's not like a computer graded it and you find out whether you pass or fail. Mm-hmm. You would just get, if you had not yet met performance criteria, then you would just go back and work on it more. So you have an opportunity to resubmit. So there are performance criteria that are defined in the micro-credential that lets an educator know this is what you have to do in order to earn it.
Okay, and Robert Brown, let me bring you into this conversation. What has been KVEC's role in developing these micro-credentials?
Often what we do is we look at areas that teachers need focus based upon data. We're involved in some work around activated catalytic transformation where we go into schools and we look at teachers, look at their data, and we may see things that the teachers may need, like collaborative leadership or in instructional strategy checklists, facilitating computer science classes, etc. We'll bring teachers together. We'll work with them on looking at those key elements that they see that they need to learn based upon data that they're collecting on their students. Recently, we're working on a stack of special ed micro-credentials. We have 10 to 12 of these working with our practitioners to develop micro-credentials focused on the needs that they have, looking at what are their students' needs and bridging the teacher's learning to the students' needs and their learning.
Okay. You mentioned special ed. I know there are a bunch of others as well. I noticed an understanding of the impact of poverty on learning, mm-hmm. for example. What are those other specialties?
Well, I think being at the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative, I think our niche in this landscape of education is around providing services to our rural region and to those teachers and to those students in that region. And so we know that our teachers and our leaders, our administrators, they have a need to know how to best reach those students that we serve. How do we reach those rural students who live in poverty? So we're very lucky at the cooperative that the staff that are there have a lot of skills and expertise around this area. They have had training with Dr. Ruby Payne, and they're licensed trainers in this area of understanding poverty. So we are developing a stack of micro-credentials. Our plan right now is 5, but we may go a little bit deeper because we're finding that this is definitely an area of interest. But the first 2 are already developed and are available. One of those is just understanding types of poverty. We have to know that just like rural is not the same everywhere, poverty is not the same everywhere. Some of our kids are coming to us as part of generational poverty. They've just over and over the years, their families have just always struggled with this area of socioeconomic issues and poverty. But then we also know that we have students that are coming to us challenged by situational poverty. Their parents have lost a job in a coal mine, or divorce has caused a problem with poverty. So this particular micro-credential is really taking an educator deep into the data that they have about their children, about the demographic data of their children, to really understand, you know, are these students living in foster homes? Are they living with their parents? Are they living with their grandparents? Are they homeless? And then how does that impact the educational services that we're providing those students? So that's the first micro-credential in the stack. And then the second one that we have developed is around building relationships. And so, you know, how do we reach out to those students and really build those strong relationships without letting education take the back burner, keeping that front and center too, and so that we are really building relationships that help the students that we serve feel a connection. And so when they're coming with trauma, social issues or whatever that are a reflection of the area they live or the socioeconomic conditions in which they live, then our teachers are better equipped to deal with that.
Let's say a teacher decides they want to take a dive into one of these modules. What's the experience?
They go through, they read research, they review articles, they look at resources. Then they take all that knowledge that they've learned into the classroom, implement the strategies they've learned, start collecting data from the students. As I'm waiting for the responses, am I getting more responses? As I'm videotaping myself and being reflective on what I'm seeing, am I learning about what I've done in the classroom? And can I reflect on the student learning for that? Then they submit that to us for scoring. Many times they're successful, sometimes they're not. So then we'll send back feedback, say, here's some things that you need to do to resubmit to be scored, because not everyone is successful first time around. The other part about this is that I think a value is they don't do this in isolation. They're working with their other teachers in their professional learning communities, their professional learning networks. They're working with their administrators, and they're building a culture of professional learning systemically throughout the district as they're looking at what are the needs of their students, what are the needs of the educators to get the students' needs.
I think a piece of this conversation that's important that it doesn't get lost is to think about it in the context of where we are as a state right now. And in the last two state budget bienniums, there has not been money funded for professional learning for educators. Mm-hmm. And our districts have still met the mandates. They've still provided 24 hours of professional learning for their educators, but that learning has not been personalized. Sometimes, you know, distance is an issue for us. A lot of times there might be a conference going on in Louisville, but you can't get someone from far reaches of Phelps and Pike County to Louisville and back in a day. So you're talking about substitutes and travel and money and things that the districts just do not have. So the distance poses a problem as well. But what we truly believe is that the micro-credential is not the next best solution to the go sit for 6 hours and listen to a presenter, that it truly is high quality, rigorous, personalized professional learning for our educators. And what we're seeing, too, is that as our educators are engaging in this type of personalized professional learning that gives them the opportunity to select a topic and go in depth into that topic and learn on their own and practice and apply and reflect, that they in turn want to develop those kinds of learning experiences for their students. It broadens their vision about what competency-based learning looks like, and we're seeing a lot of that going on in our classrooms, too.
So especially in the atmosphere that we're in today, and in terms of the fiscal nature of our state, I would think that what you just said answers the question to the parent or the non-educator who's out there listening, but who is concerned about workforce development, about what it implies to have a well-educated population. Why this matters.
Yes, it definitely does. And we also know that we have a lot of educators who are coming out of pipelines. They're alternative pipelines. They're alternatively certified, or, you know, they've come through a MAT program and they have not had a lot of extensive pre-service education. And many of these micro-credentials are designed for new and emerging educators. So if I do not know about classroom management, or I do not know about how to design assessments, or I do not know about certain instructional strategies, I can select these micro-credentials and I can learn and grow. These teachers who are engaging in micro-credentialing are seeing statistically significant impact on student performance. Their kids are performing better.
A teacher's listening to this, they're thinking, I think I need to engage in that. How do they do that? Where do they go? Is there a fee involved?
For us, with our teachers, the micro-credentials are free. So they can go online, look at what they need, design their professional learning plan, complete their micro-credentials. If there is a fee, there may be a slight assessor fee, like for $25, which is still cheaper than going to a conference for $200 and traveling and then back and your substitute time, things like that. So it takes place of all that, because a lot of this can be done at home. It can be done at weekends. It can be done during part of their PLC time when teachers are talking together.
Yeah, and if a teacher is, you know, listening to this and they're saying, oh, I want to go check these out. Or, you know, even if just a parent wanted to see what are some of these topics that educators are seeking professional learning in? Our micro credentials are housed on a national platform. So the platform is through Digital Promise. So folks can look at microcredentials.digitalpromise.org and they'll be able to see those. But, you know, if someone wanted to have more conversation about how this work is happening at KVEC, because this idea about bringing educators in and partnering with them and the development of micro-credentials, that's very unique. I mean, that is something that KVEC is proud of, the fact that we're building the capacity of educators to engage in this type of work. So if they wanted to speak with Robert or I, you know, we would be happy to engage in some more in-depth conversation. And, you know, I think we say this a lot when we're talking to administrators who are trying to wrap their mind around how do I or should I introduce micro-credentialing as a component of a professional learning system in my school or in my district. And what I always say to them is, you know, I've been in education for a long time, and I've done a lot of professional development. I've been that person standing up in front of a room of 200 educators and doing a training. And at the end of the day, when those folks leave and I give them a certificate, basically all that certificate says is you did a really great job of sitting in that chair for 6 hours. Mm-hmm. Because I have no idea if you learned anything. I have no idea if you're taking anything back to apply it in your classroom. I don't know if it's impacting your professional practice. I don't know if it's impacting your student outcomes. But with a micro-credential, I can see those things.
Well, it's so good in today's atmosphere to be talking about positive things like this in the world of education. And Dr. Jennifer Carroll, Robert Brown from the Kentucky Valley Educational Cooperative, thank you so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, Tom Eblin here with the 2020 inductees into the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000.
Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-622-WEKU. It could be used in a future show. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or other past episodes? You can find them online at weku.fm or the WEKU mobile app. Now back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Kentucky is known for its writers, Wendell Berry, Bobby Ann Mason, Jesse Stewart, Silas House, Eric Reese, Gurney Norman, George Ella Lyon, Ed McClanahan, Harlan Hubbard, Frank X. Walker. That list goes on. And every year since 2013, in recognition of these great works and as encouragement to budding and future writers, new names are added to the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame, a creation of the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. The inductees for 2020 have been decided, and here to tell us about them is Carnegie Center Arts Liaison, Tom Eblin. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be with you.
So, Tom, how many inductees this year, and how are these selections being made?
Well, this year we have one living inductee and four deceased ones, and we have a process that we use for getting the nominees. First, we ask the public for suggestions, and we get quite a number of people for their favorite Kentucky writers. Then at the Carnegie Center, we have a committee that winnows those down to about, this year it was about 10 living and about 15 deceased writers who we thought had a good chance this year. Then we send that big list to the Kentucky Arts Council, and they have a committee that's made up of some of the state's best writers. And they kind of rank those in terms of what they think. And then based on their rankings and kind of, you know, we're always looking for a good mix of people, then we make the final selections at the Carnegie Center.
So there's criteria that is followed?
Right. We're particularly looking for literary writers and those who have made a big impact nationally and in the arts.
Okay, let's talk about who's being honored this year, briefly about each. And first, the newest living inductee is Sina Jeter Naslin of Louisville. Tell us about her.
Yes, Ms. Naslin has lived in Kentucky since 1973. She's originally from Birmingham, Alabama. But she has written a number of best-selling novels, including Ahab's Wife, which was a really interesting take on the Moby Dick story from the perspective of Captain Ahab's wife, who in Melville's original novel just got a sentence or two. And Naslin wove a whole story around that. She also wrote about The Four Spirits, which was about the 16th Street church bombing back in 1963 in Birmingham, Alabama, which she lived in Birmingham at the time and told me that she had always promised herself she would write a novel about that. That was another bestseller. And others include Adam and Eve and Abundance, which was a novel about Marie Antoinette.
It's interesting, in the two cases of Ahab's Wife and the Birmingham bombing, there's a bit of journalism there as well and history.
Yeah, she does a lot of historical research, and we talked about that. She writes a lot of historical novels, and she, of course, invents characters and scenes and things. But she really likes to be true to the history, and that requires a lot of research and a lot of in-depth work. Of course, she's also a really noted teacher. She was a creative writing professor, kind of started the creative writing program at the University of Louisville. And then at Spalding College, she helped start the low residency MFA in creative writing at Spalding, which has become one of the nation's top programs in that. So she's also got major credentials as a teacher as well as a writer of creative fiction.
The remainder of this year's inductees are posthumous, all posthumous. Let's run down this list and tell me something about each and begin with Hollis Summers.
Well, Hollis Summers was born in Henry County, Kentucky, in Eminence, and grew up around the state, mostly in Madisonville, went to Georgetown College, and then he got his master's at Middlebury College at the Breadloaf School, which is a famous creative writing program, and then a PhD from the University of Iowa, which is another top program. He was a teacher at first Georgetown College and then for a decade at the University of Kentucky. What's notable about his tenure there is he was a teacher and mentor to a group of Kentucky writers who would later become famous, Wendell Berry, Bobby Ann Mason, Ed McClanahan, Gurney Norman, you know, that group. And so after he left UK in 1959 and then went to Ohio University. But he wrote a number of short story collections, a number of novels and poetry, and was just kind of an all-around literary mind in Kentucky.
Also on the list is Lucy Furman.
Lucy Furman was born in Henderson in 1869, and kind of her first book was about a kind of life in a little town near Henderson that ironically is where a lot of my ancestors are from. But she moved to eastern Kentucky in the early 1900s and was an early staff member of Heinemann Settlement School. While at Heinemann, she wrote a number of novels about that were kind of fictionalized version of her life in the mountains, the most notable of which was The Quare Women, which the University Press of Kentucky republished this year with a new introduction by poet Rebecca Gale Howell.
This next one on the list is somebody that occasionally would run across right here at the studio. He would be up here doing voice work or something of that sort. And, of course, he's the great playwright, Sam Shepard.
You know, Sam Shepard was not from Kentucky, but he spent a lot of the last 17 years of his life at a horse farm in Midway. He was also, in addition to being a playwright, a writer, an actor, a dedicated horse breeder and bred some stakes winners. But Shepard, a lot of people just know him as an actor because he was very popular, but he wrote something like 44 plays, including one Pulitzer Prize winner and a couple of others that were nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. He was probably one of the foremost playwrights of his generation.
And fourth on the list is Cleanth Brooks.
Yes, Brooks was from Murray, Kentucky, and was educated at Vanderbilt. And while he was at Vanderbilt in the 20s, one of his classmates and a lifelong colleague would become Robert Penn Warren. And they went from Vanderbilt to teaching at LSU and then moved on to Yale University, where both of them spent most of their career. But Brooks was probably the foremost literary critic of the 20th century in America. And most people who took literature classes in college probably used the textbooks that Brooks and Warren wrote.
So, Tom, this year's Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame ceremony includes something that's occasional. It's a new occasional award, the Kentucky Literary Impact Award. Who's the recipient and why?
Well, we decided to create this award because we thought there needed to be some way to recognize someone who was not necessarily a writer, but someone who had a real profound impact on literature and the literary tradition in Kentucky. And our first award, you know, first honoree couldn't be better for that. That's Gray Zeitz, who founded Larkspur Press, which is now 45 years old. Larkspur is a small press, little printing shop up in Monterey, near outside of Monterey in Owen County. And for 45 years, Zeitz has printed these really elegant letter, handmade letterpress books that have been, you know, some of the – he really focuses on Kentucky writers. And some of his books have been the first books of some very noted Kentucky writers.
And what was the driver? What was the motivation behind the Carnegie Center creating the Hall of Fame in the first place?
Well, Neil Chethick, our executive director, had been thinking about, you know, the great – not only the great literary tradition in Kentucky with, you know, dozens and dozens of nationally and internationally known writers, but the fact that we have such a vibrant literary community in Kentucky today. So the idea was to try to draw attention to that and really to make people kind of remember and reflect and reread many of these great Kentucky writers and current Kentucky writers who have made a splash on the national scene.
Okay, details. When is it happening and where will it happen?
Well, the ceremony this year will be February 5th, which is a Wednesday night, at the Kentucky Theater on Main Street.
Tom Eblin here as Carnegie Center Arts Liaison talking about the Kentucky Writers Hall of Fame. Thanks for coming in, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Before we go, I'd like to tell you about something you'll hear in next week's edition of Eastern Standard. We're going to begin a year-long series celebrating the centennial of the ratification of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which states, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Congress shall have power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation." The 19th Amendment of the Constitution of the United States and those 39 words mark the culmination of the women's suffrage movement in the U.S. Well, this milestone came after a lengthy and difficult struggle. Victory took decades of agitation and protest. The sheer volume of brand new voters created by this legal action made it the single biggest democratizing event in American history. Our series of monthly interviews about this turning point in history and what has been or is yet to be achieved will be researched and hosted by EKU Associate Professors Carolyn DuPont and Jackie Jay.
First they said we couldn't dance, then said we couldn't drink. And unless a man allowed it, they said we couldn't think. They said we shouldn't speak till we were spoken to. Well, there was just so much back then we weren't allowed to do. But the first bite of that apple, I guess, revealed the truth. That's when Eve got smart and that's why Adam don't like fruit. But that old tree of knowledge had some limbs that broke. We had to fight for women's rights. They said we couldn't vote.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.fm or esweku.com, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.